It's July 27, 2007. It's Watt from Pedro's show.
Thank you.
The Watt from Pedro show. I'm doing it here, Tokyo, July 27, 2007. Sorry, I just got done recording with some musicians here. I have a band called Migu, and did a couple tunes at a studio called Noah. And meeting me there was my guest today, Mr. Jim O'Rourke.
Hello, everybody.
Right, and you just picked this song we last heard.
Oh, great. Sachiko Kanenobu. This is kind of... Sachiko Kanenobu. She was... she only made one record in, like, 1972, maybe? And she was sort of like the answer to Joni Mitchell.
Here.
Yeah, here. But it's, of course, different. It's a fantastic record.
But she only made, but different.
Yeah. And the song was, that was Far Away From You.
Okay, we started off with Leo by John Coltrane, Alive in Japan, his last tour. I think Elvin Jones said he was holding his side on this tour. It was heavy, but he's probably playing his heart out. Mr. Jim now lives here in Tokyo, right?
Sort of, yeah, I rarely leave, let's put it that way.
Okay. Well, I mean, you got a pad?
Yeah. I managed to find a place. It took me about a year, but I found a place, and it's complete. I mean, I never bought a place in the States. You know, I never got a permanent place in the States, really, but it's definitely a different process here than it would be in the States.
Yeah, right.
And you still got the visa ride.
Yeah, yeah, that's very difficult. It's easy if you have a job, I guess. It seems to be, but I don't do anything they consider to be work, so it hasn't been that easy.
Yeah. So you got to do what, the 3 month dance?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not working, so it's not really a problem. But it becomes a bit troublesome after a while.
Yeah.
But I went to Bali a few weeks ago. Because it actually was end up being a lot cheaper to go to Bali than to go back to the States or someplace else.
Closer.
Yeah, yeah, it was closer. And Bali's very, very...
Econo.
It was very interesting.
I've never been there. I'd like to go. What was it like?
Well, the food was really good. And, it's all broken. All the cities are not the cities, the neighborhoods aren't actually that close together. But a lot of that kind of like people following you on the streets trying to sell you anything they got their hands on, and that kind of scene, and people who have vans that no longer have doors or a hood, but they've decided, I guess, that it's a taxi, and if you're walking, you're fair game for their ride. So, and they drive you. So you've got streets filled with extremely slow moving. Near-death automobiles yelling at people on the streets.
on
the sidewalks. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't think I saw a car move at a regular pace ever the whole time.
Did they have any man-powered?
Yes, they did. Yeah, they did. Because
I saw some today in...
Asakusa.
Asakusa.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There was guys... I mean, it's pretty warm here right now. Mm. Very humid, and this guy's running down the street carrying these two people in the rickshaw, or maybe they're not called rickshaw.
What are they called? I forgot.
Something with shaw at the end, right? Because that means cars. Like the bikes are called...
Shitensha, which means like...
Shitensha.
By yourself making move.
Car.
Yeah, a car, yeah, basically, yeah.
By yourself.
Well, see, it's funny because I don't speak English that much anymore,
Yeah.
So...
How long? A year?
Up until maybe 6 months ago, I still couldn't get through a whole day just speaking Japanese. But now I'm rarely speaking English. So my sentence structure is... I'm using, it's like you get rewired a bit.
Yeah.
So, when I said, when I said by yourself moving car, that sounds weird, but in my head it made complete sense because that's how you think. Yeah.
Yeah,
I remember I went back to New York at one point last right at the end of the year, and I was helping a friend record a record, and after a take I said, "That was how," and he's like, "What?" I was like, "The take was how." He's like, "What are you talking about?" I was like, "The take was how," and I couldn't comprehend why he was looking at me with this, and then I realized I was speaking backwards.
Right. Don't care me.
Yeah. Right. Right. Right.
They say stuff like
that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, you learned it pretty rapid. Is it the Berlitz immersion technique?
No, it's like my own. I just started on my own.
It's your own immersion.
Yeah.
But you're swimming in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was once I came here for on a long haul basis, then it started really, because there's nothing else. What are you gonna do? Yeah. You can walk
sign
around.
Sign language.
So.
You did it. But that's commendable.
I don't know.
No, all these people that live here and stuff are telling me how amazed the progress you made.
They're being very kind.
Okay.
That was nice.
Well, in the studio, you were rapping with everybody real good. So that was happening. Very happy. I was very impressed. And... Because I'd probably be a stumble bum at it for years
you'd get it quick because it's got an amazing architecture to it, the way that the language works. And it's like a system, and it's almost like putting a puzzle together because there's very specific rules. It's much more, it sticks to rules much more than, what it's like? Did you ever use one of those old, modular synthesizers where you use the... You've seen them where you use, it looks like an operating board. A telephone operator's board.
I remember the guy in Ubu, Ravenstein.
Yeah, yeah. That's
EML
how it works.
Or something.
That's how it works, yeah. So it's like, for instance, if you want to do something to a verb, it's very set. If you want to you know, articulate the verb this way, you plug this in at the end. Or if you want to do this with it, you plug this at the end. Or if you want to modify this whole phrase, you plug it into this. You know.
What do you think about for writing song lyrics? So I've always wondered about Italian, every word ending with vowels.
Well, the thing you can do with Japanese, and I'm sure with Chinese as well, there's all sorts of stuff you can do with, you know, writing and lyrics, of course, too, that you can't do in English or any sort of, what do they call it, Roman languages?
Yeah.
Romance. Because Romance language. Because the alphabet, the figures themselves have no meaning, inherent meaning. So, for instance, because you're using kanji, the kanjis have many different sounds. You know, it's not just like this kanji is sha or this kanji is ka. It can have several. And it's regulated by, for instance, what letter or kanji it's next to. But then there's also there's meanings within the kanji themselves. So you could use, you know, for instance, a word like kayu has many, many meanings. If you just hear it, you don't actually know which kayu it is. So when you're reading, you can see it. It's very apparent which one it is. But then the combination of the kanjis has multiple opportunities for meanings.
Right.
But also from that, and this is something that I had to learn the hard way, because I've yet to see it in any sort of teaching book on Japanese, is that there's words that are only for reading and writing. Because so many words sound the same. There's plenty of words that you only use for speaking. I mean, all the words you use for speaking you can write, but there's an enormous amount of the words you would never say. Okay. Because it sounds like another word, and that word is more common. So it's like the most common... I'm simplifying it, but the most common words are ones for speaking, and there's multitudes more words that you generally wouldn't say.
Because of the there dilemma.
Yeah. There. You know, and but
they're going to the show.
Right.
They're in their car.
Right. But because of that, you have amazing possibilities for, you know, puns and wordplay, because of it's not just the sound; it's then what kanji you're using, and then the combination of the meanings of the kanji. You can do all sorts of fascinating things, and you can create words very easily that way.
Well, what about the other one, the phonetic, the hiragana?
Oh, the hiragana is like, that's used mostly for like conjugating verbs and, you know, connections of words, because like punctuation is said. Like there's really no periods, commas. You actually say a comma. There's there's words that have those
like
meanings.
Like the old telegraphs.
Yeah, it is like that actually. It is like that, and there's all sorts of like... Yeah, that's what desu is. You know, you always hear people, desu. Desu is stop. It's not stop.
I hear
stop.
A lot of highs.
Well, I just did.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But the listener, too, to make sure that they're following along.
Right, because the context can get lost a lot quicker in Japanese than in English. Because they don't use pronouns as much in the Japanese language. So once the subject of what you're about to speak, I just did it again. Whatever you're going to talk about, once you've stated it, you drop pronouns. That you don't say I or you or that thing. You don't say it continuously as much. I didn't notice it as much until I started speaking Japanese, how much you do it in English. It's like every fourth word is a pronoun, probably. At least it seems to me. I think you can be precise in Japanese. It's just not the practice. You know,
obviously,
what I mean?
They're building some pretty precise things.
Yeah. I mean, it's completely
capable. Right, they're not just painters.
Right, I mean, it's completely possible to be precise in Japanese. It's just not the manner. I mean, I'm simplifying it, but where in English, because you do things like you use pronouns and constantly restate what the subject is and what the reference is, I think from the Japanese-speaking perspective, it's more precise.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's
kind
of a perspective thing. But it's completely possible, I think. I mean, I think maybe I still have a bit of that in my speaking, so I overstate things in Japanese more than I need to. You know, but in a way that's being precise in the way that maybe they are wanting.
Right.
But it seems so awkward to do that, you know.
Well, we're precisely at the end of the first hour, so that's a whole lot for hour two. July 27, 2007, second hour of the Watt from Pedro show.
As it may, the world still leads away. cache la dernière coupe de vis. Et tu échoueras quelque part entre ma queue et mes aiguilles. Et mieux jouer un peu pour que quand je me refile, on voit mon cul, on voit mon pied, on voit mon cul. Même que j'aurai des genoux pour mettre des chaussettes. Et si ça me sert trop, je boutonnerai pas.
ここは俺たちの戦場。 静かな最前線夜明けミツバメ飛び鳴く朝焼けの街角に
取引の成功を祈って乾杯
この風に舞う真珠色した地平道の荒野に俺は小さな炎を放つ燃やせよ夜明けよ燃やせよ街の夜明けを炎ほよここは炎ほよここは俺たちの戦
Watt from Pedro Show. Hey Jim, you pick these songs here. What did we hear first?
First we
heard, kick off the second hour.
That was an English band called T2. I think also from 1972. And they also made only one record.
Wow. It's a magic year.
Yeah, well, I think it was actually. And that was a song called JLT. It was like a trio, bass, drums, guitar.
Ah, Power Trio.
Yeah, I it's one of my favorite records. Actually. It's fantastic. And then I think it's available now. I think it got reissued finally.
Did anybody go on to make other bands?
You know, I think maybe a member went on to like be in a band that was even less known. You know, I think maybe him and his friend played at the bar. You know, I don't mean that in a dismissive way. I mean, I think that's actually what happened. Although I'm not really sure. Then after that was kind of a slight cult figure from France named Albert Marcoure, and he's the kind of guy who makes a record like once every 5 or 8 years. You know, he works on it interminably, and that was
no wine before it's time.
Oh yeah, and his stuff is so immaculately put together, and that was from his fifth record. And that was a tune called Ballade, or I'm not going to even try to do the French with a sound, Ballade aux gens. And that's a fantastic record. I love it. I'm crazy about that record. And he plays almost everything on it. I think his brother played drums, and maybe he'd have somebody else every once in a while, but he played immense amount of instruments. I think all the woodwinds and brass and guitars and keyboards and just kind of it's a little proggy, but
it's okay.
It's a little, you know, like a lot of this stuff, a little bit of a Zappa influence and a little bit of a Beach Boys influence, but I like it quite a bit. And then after that was a song that is from a film once again 1972.
Yeah,
actually, a Japanese film called Tenshi no Kokotsu, which was made by a director named Koji Wakamatsu, and written by another director from that time named Masao Adachi, and they were both involved with a lot of the left wing groups in Japan at the time, and the Japanese Red Army as well. You know, the terrorist group, and Adachi himself would actually, after that, leave for Palestine to join the Red Army, and was there for 30 years until just a couple years ago. He was arrested and brought back to Japan. He didn't take part in any terrorist activity, so he got out after 2 years.
And wasn't the boss a woman? They caught her?
Yeah, they caught her, yeah. They caught
or the last boss.
Yeah, yeah. They caught her a couple years ago in Osaka. They didn't... They didn't know she had sneaked back into Japan. And the funny thing about how she got caught is she used to have, and this is speaking 30 years ago, have a very, very kind of peculiar way of blowing smoke rings from her cigarettes. And some, like, old guy who remembered this from 30 years ago. Is it okay? Can you still hear me? Or are you checking for police mics? It's not a bad idea. A guy 30 years later in Osaka saw a woman on the street blowing smoke rings that reminded him of her. I've read this and I've heard this. I mean, I'm sure there's other details to it, but that's an interesting aspect. She got caught 30 years later because of a smoke ring. Her crime ring was caught because of her smoke ring. But this film was the last film they made together, and it was about this thing that was happening in Tokyo at the time called the Great Tokyo Osaka War, which was the kind of the wings of the Red Army that were in Osaka and Tokyo. They were sort of attacking police boxes, and you know, there was a incident that happened the week that the film premiered. Right across the street from the movie theater, it was called the Christmas Tree Incident. And you can see it in Shinjuku still. One of the main corners, there was a Christmas tree next to the police box, and some of the terrorists had thrown... maybe that's the wrong word to use. I don't want to get involved in that. They put a bomb in the Christmas tree, and it blew up the police box. And they almost immediately, you know, investigated the film screening because there was, you know, there had been connections between them, so there was a lot of trouble.
They got Christmas trees here.
Yeah, and they do. Okay. But
so Chris, is it a big deal here?
Christmas ga ninki desu ka? I guess so.
Okay. Well, you've been here for one Christmas at least.
Yeah, but I kind of ignore it.
Okay.
Well, you know, the Christmas vacation here is really, really long, but it's not a Christmas, it's because of something, it's a New Year's vacation. It's like 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks long, and, yeah, I kind of, you know, I just keep myself locked up anyway.
Okay.
You know, so this is a song from that movie.
People put up lights?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's more and more the more sort of shop-oriented parts of town.
Yeah,
I don't see it like in the so much in the residential areas at all. That's actually what it is. Like in Ginza or Shibuya or places like that, there are a lot of it, but not so much in neighborhoods. I haven't seen much of it. Yeah, but
I'm just curious.
Yeah. It's you know, I mean, you know, they like Jesus too.
Okay.
Although there are much more Christians here, I think, than is commonly known. I was surprised when, you know, I first started coming here and I saw Christian churches and I was like, what? And I talked to some people, I'm like, well, there's... And then, of course, I started studying the history and found out that, you know
Jesuits.
Yeah.
Portugal.
Yeah, exactly.
The word arigato and abrigato.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
Does he even have a word?
Yeah. You know, actually, it's funny. There was this film this director, Shinoda, made maybe like 30 years ago called Silence, which is about a story about the first Portuguese Jesuit, what do you call it? The priests who go places and... What do you call it?
Missionary,
right. And I guess that's going to be Scorsese's next movie. He's doing a remake of it.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Because they're like the bad guys in the Shogun movie.
The Jesuits? I don't know if I've ever seen Shogun.
Or something. Or the England guys.
Right.
Because they're Protestant.
Right.
Some secret cabal.
Oh, I have to check that out. I think at first they weren't seen as that. You know, there's of course a lot.
No, not by the people here. It was by the England.
Because
they're rivals.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah. That is true. And then of course the whole business too, the whole mercantile thing between the Dutch, German. Yeah. So I think the Dutch were allowed to stay after everyone else was kicked out. The Dutch were allowed to stay for a while to continue to do business. And then everybody got kicked out for I think like, what was it, 100 years.
Yeah. Right. To the open door.
Yeah.
We were in the train thing, and there's Perry on the wall.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
You're open for business.
Right.
So, film.
Yeah.
Big reason you came here?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it sounds silly, but I mean, you know, I'd wanted to learn Japanese a long time, but you know, it's, you don't really get encouraged when like films still have subtitles and stuff, you know, and it's like, oh yeah, well, I'll get around to it. And I ran out. I was like, okay, I guess I'm gonna have to stick with it. And you know, I think during the last Sonic tour, I started learning the hiragana and katakana, you know, and tried to study on the road, and it didn't work. You know,
but language and film, you're working on.
Yeah, that. Yeah. Like I've been, because a lot of these directors I really love. Some, you know, a lot of them are still alive, but they're, you know, and getting on. Although they're from a very, they're strong stock. It seems these guys they drink you under the table and still, you know, still dance home. You know? And so yeah, I mean, that's a big part of the culture here that I like, and it's not necessarily contemporary. You know, there's sort of like a certain period I really fascinated with, and I'm fascinated by the history from that time too.
So. But you're not doing a lot of music here.
No, not really.
You mixed Mayo's record.
Yeah, yeah. That was funny. You know, I mean, like, if friends come, you know, and they want to play, I'll play and stuff. But I'm like, not doing. I think I still need time away to actually be able to, because I haven't done anything of my own in like 6 years now.
Whoa.
I still think I need, like, I think I need to stop completely so that I can actually start again.
Well, maybe it'd be neat to tell folks how you got into music.
You know, it's actually funny. When I was six, you know, my parents were kind of your Chicago, from Ireland, kind of, they were both orphans, and you remember, I forget what the name of that kind of famous book years ago about how priests in Ireland would take orphan girls and make them their maids, and then they would send them to parishes around the world, and they were not really slaves, but basically, I forget, there was a famous book about that a couple of years ago. My mom was one of those girls. So she got sent to Chicago, and then my father, you know, they didn't meet in Ireland. So I wanted an 8mm camera for Christmas.
Six.
Yeah, yeah, I wanted an 8mm camera, and they didn't have the money. And my mother had somebody in the family line who played accordion. And because he played accordion, they said, well, you know, maybe he'll be a musician. So they bought me this Sears acoustic guitar.
Not an accordion.
No. Yeah. Thank goodness. Oh, that might have been okay. Then I could have played keyboard.
Yeah.
I sometimes regret that.
My organ player, Pete, the second man.
He started on the accordion?
And ended up on Hammond B3. So.
Does he still play the accordion?
Oh, yeah. Like a motherfucker.
Really? Can he do the keys to the buttons?
Chromatics.
Oh, wow.
Slav Italian weddings.
Oh, really?
You had to learn all the tunage.
Oh, wow.
But so you get the Sears guitar?
Yeah, and I guess I just started from there. I remember the first thing I played was the Pink Panther theme.
Whoa.
Because I think you can play with the open strings, I think. You know, and I remember my parents being really impressed, and I was like, well, it's the open strings. I mean.
So once you started copying records?
Yeah, I was really into Paul McCartney then, so I wanted to, I used to put up, I remember when Band on the Run came out, I used to prop it up on the mirror in my room and like look in the mirror and like look at me and then look at the picture of Paul in the corner and go, yeah, I look like Paul McCartney.
Do you know the story behind that song? Somebody told me it was about him getting arrested here in Japan for a lot of mota.
But wasn't he arrested after that record?
I don't know. That's what somebody told me in the Stooges crew.
I think they might have a... I think they may have the flow of time reversed.
Like a suitcase full. Is that right, though?
Yeah, I mean, I forget how much he had, but, you know, yeah.
And he can't ever come.
No, he was able to. They eventually okay. Rescinded and let him in.
Because that was another thing the experts told me.
I forget who it was, but, you know, so many people have not been able to come in because of things like that.
Oh.
You know.
So, you're copying Paul McCartney, so I'm looking at posters.
Right.
Till about 37.
Maybe so.
No.
Well, actually, I was really excited about that.
But you started playing with people,
yeah.
Huh?
And then, you know, in school I was playing, and then...
Did you have bands in school?
And I'd release records. You know, I recorded...
Were you writing songs? Can you remember your first song you wrote?
Oh, actually, I do. It's actually, the lyrics were funny. I found them a few years ago. The lyrics were written on the back of the poster for
Band on the Run.
Yeah, maybe Band on the Run. No, actually, it was Dark Side of the Moon. You know how all the posters? And the...
There were two posters, actually.
Yeah, and then like maybe 8x11s or something. And I swear to God, the lyrics were, I was walking down the street, I saw a girl explode. I think maybe that was like a sort of like a... You know,
stream
like,
of conscious.
Not stream of conscious. I think the explode was maybe like a stage direction.
Oh.
You know, I was thinking like, and then everything will blow up.
Leopold Bloom and Ulysses, you know, he's just, thoughts collide.
Yeah. And then, you know, I got
with the lyrics first?
No. I think that's the only time I ever did. I didn't write lyrics again for like 30 years. And I got an amp with a spring reverb, and I remember I made this 8-track cassette called War, and I drew the cover, and it had like a tank, you know, crushing somebody maybe, and it was, you know, the 8-track cassette was called War, and it was just me shaking the spring reverb for the whole time.
Yeah. Did you hear Metal Machine Music?
No, I hadn't.
Okay.
You know, it might have been close, because I bought it on 8-track. Bought Metal Machine Music on 8-track. There was a Walgreens.
You had an 8-track recorder.
Yeah. Well, the stereo, you could record it.
Yeah, I know some people had those.
Yeah. The Woolworths near our house had like 99-cent 8-tracks. So, you know, by that time I was into Jethro Tull and The Who. And, you know, I was really into Jethro Tull.
Remember when they played Five Nights at the Forum?
Oh, really?
They were a huge band at one point. Oh, yeah, in the 70s.
The funny thing is, when I went to see them, you know, until I was like 13, my dad would still go with me to shows.
Tell me about the first gig.
Oh, the first gig. Oh, you know about that?
Yeah, you told me.
Oh, I do. Okay.
The spaghetti gig.
No. So
it was Wings.
Yeah, it was Wings. It was in 75. And, I don't want to get into so much about my mother. Let's just say my mother had a tendency to, how do they say these days? Act out? is that the humorous way people say it now? So we were eating dinner before we went to the show, and my father was taking me, and my sister was going too, and we were eating spaghetti, and she got mad about something or other, and she picked up a plate of spaghetti and threw it at the wall above my head, and it cracked and landed in my hair. And so my dad goes, go clean your hair out. And she goes, no, he's going to the show like that, no. So,
of course.
Yeah. So in the car, my dad let me pull out as much as I could. But I still had bits of plate and spaghetti in my hair. And this is the funny thing. I still remember vividly, like it was at the Chicago Auditorium, which doesn't exist anymore. And we're in the sort of, you know, that sort of cattle call line, you know, like they have at banks where it's
to
like
the Salt Lake.
Yeah. to get in. And I remember seeing little comic books on the floor. And I was like, oh, wow, a comic book. And I picked it up. And it was this weird, long, slender-sized comic book. And I go, Dad, look, a comic book. He's like, oh, those are no good. And it was a chick comic.
Yes, of course.
It was a chick comic. So, yeah. And so I watched Wings with the spaghetti and china in my hair.
Paul didn't stop the game.
No. He's like, yeah, man. That guy's going, I want everybody to go crazy like that little kid over there.
Yeah. So you get some guys at school to make a band.
There was a guy, Dave Arndt. Yeah, Dave Arndt and I were a band. But I was in the band in school, which was
school band.
Yeah, school band. And I played, that's how I started playing percussion.
Ah.
And then... Yeah, so I played percussion.
So junior high or high?
It's like, that's grade school.
Grade school?
Yeah. So, like, I can't play drum set at all, but I can play, like, you know, orchestra drums and things like that. So from that I learned to read.
Grade school even had a band.
Well, that's it was like, you know, you know, like, you know, garbage. But, you know, from that I learned how to read, you know, I was able to learn how to read music. By high school, there was the jazz band, and that's when, but there were already enough guitar players, so that's why I had to switch to bass.
Ah.
Because the teacher said, okay, you're playing bass.
Stand up.
Yeah. No, it was...
Wow.
No, the jazz band, I played electric bass in the orchestra, there was, see, I went to a Catholic boys' school.
Yeah.
And then next to it was the Catholic girls' school.
Yeah.
And so, the girls' school had orchestra, the boys' school had concert band. And then shared, there was the jazz band. Like, the girls could be in the jazz band.
Co-ed.
Too. Yeah, I got co-ed jazz band. The way it should be. And so I played double bass in the orchestra, and then I played bass electric bass in a jazz band.
Wow.
Yeah.
But at home, you're still playing guitar.
I don't think I played guitar much during those years. Wait. Yeah, I think I just sort of... But that's when I started playing, you know, the weirdo guitar, because by that time I was starting to get into free jazz and stuff, and like...
But you never had a garage band doing...
No, I never really did.
Wow.
I think maybe...
Doing the Wings covers or...
No, not really. Okay. No, I never really did.
But you like learning them in the bedroom just
Yeah.
But you're doing bass, versions of bass, but you're playing music, you know, that they got you in class. You're not at home playing bass off records.
No. But I think I learned normal kind of playing on bass more than I did on the guitar.
Okay.
Because by the time I got started getting in, you know, because at the library I'd get out like, you know, because, you know, those that was a time where a lot of those... You know, like non-Suchian labels like that were putting out John Cage records and stuff.
Sure.
So I remember I got a record called New Forms for Piano, which I think was on New World, which had like had Cage and it had Henry Cowell, and you know it was a long description on what the prepared piano was.
Wow.
And so.
But that's a leap, man, from Wings to non-Such.
Well, that's about, you know.
But, you know, Wings, I can understand, though, no, the way you got to it. Because that's the Wings is on the radio.
Yeah.
What hipped you to that stuff? Cats in School?
No, it's really just going to the... Well, it started because of Absolutely Free, the Zappa record. Because he had a big list inside of all the things he liked. And so, I mean, I got that out of the library. You know, it wasn't that hard to find out about Zappa, of course.
No.
You know, you'd read, like, the Rolling Stone Guide to Records. You know, of course, he's in there.
Yeah.
And I just, that's how
he was also on FM with some funny songs.
Yeah, that was, like, around the time of, like, you know, exactly. And
maybe not Mothers, but there was a period where he kind of was on. In fact, he was kind of on a cusp of a prog thing or a fuge. With the funny things, so he could get on the FM radio with the Black Dog. And
but, you know, the thing is, I mean, you know this. You look back at a lot of those bands, even the most popular bands, and those songs are much more involved in the writing. You know, so it's, you know, a lot of the stuff that we don't think of as prog would, compared to a lot of stuff that came afterwards, is very, very proggy.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Like, I was huge into 10cc. And that kind of pop music. I like 10cc, or I didn't like Queen so much then, although I liked them. But I like that sort of that kind of 10cc sort of mad scientist kind of pop. You know, I like that stuff. So, you know, from the Zap, I found out about Stravinsky.
Okay.
And for example, like Stravinsky, there'd be a record on Deutsche Grammophon. I'd say, oh, well.
Yeah. And you're at the library.
At the library, so I'd pull
it
out.
I didn't even know about the library shit for a long time. No, that's how fucked up the 70s was for us.
Yeah.
You know, if it wasn't in that certain set of records that was being pushed,
right,
we didn't even know that they existed.
Right.
I learned about all that stuff from punk people, because they knew all about all kinds of music, these cats in that scene.
Right.
I never stumbled upon any of it.
Right.
You know? Some glam.
Yeah.
There was some glam wasn't big in the U.S.
Yeah.
Like, where they'd have one hit like T-Rex.
Yeah.
But that was about the most, obscure music I even had. And then later, there was a station called KPFK Pacifica, and they'd have shows where cats would play Subotnik and...
Right.
Kind of,
yeah.
Some guy scratching on a balloon. It sounded like, you know, and it's like, whoa, this is music. Yeah, all right. And that's, and plus meeting punk people.
Yeah,
I got turned on. It's like 77 and that stuff.
Yeah.
I started getting hip to that, and I've always been curious on how people found that.
Yeah,
older brothers.
Yeah.
Some music thing, and you got it from a Zappa record.
Yeah, that's where it kind of really all branched out from there. Just from that list, it really
That's
did.
That's great. So you start, and now this gives you, I don't know, cojones to start whacking out a guitar at home?
Yeah, I remember, actually, the first time I tried it was my mom, for some reason, bought me Avon, like, boys cologne. And it was like... still remember this. And it was like a football player in mid-throw. And, like, from the waist down, it was, like, blue, clear glass that the magic elixir had been put in.
And, foo-foo.
Right. And above was, like, this white rubber, you know. And I remember, I was, like, rubbing the rubber against the guitar. And I was like... And I was like, yes. Mom, that does not sound like practice, my mother. That does not sound like what your teacher gave you.
Are you recording it?
No, I was just goofing around.
No, but you're making recordings?
What
did the War 8 track sound like?
Well,
it's just like... But is it part of this era?
That was like McCartney time.
Wow.
I just thought it was like, you know, because I was like,
but
yeah,
it was just
war.
A coincidence.
Yeah.
You didn't know about Deutsche Grammophon.
No, that came a little later. And
you know, I can do it, so I'm going to do it.
Right.
I don't know other cats are.
I remember calling up the operator and going, "How's that sound?
I got an audience."
Right, exactly.
Time Lady's next.
Well, my dad had an old reel-to-reel recorder, and then he had like one of those early slimline cassette players, you know. So like I'd play something onto the reel-to-reel, and then I play that out through the speaker.
Oh, the best kind of bouncing.
Yeah, and bounce back and forth. And because the sound changed, I think I really got into like these kind of degraded sounds.
And then Lou Barlow told me that's how he overdubbed.
Yeah,
two tape recorders just playing for each other.
So I think that's how that started. But of course, I remember doing regular music at that time. You know,
yeah,
like, you know, Neil Diamond. I think even didn't he?
But not
that?
Bands yet.
No, okay. I didn't play.
When's the first band?
The first actual band, like in the terms of it being a real band. First not actual band. Well, I guess it was.
I know in the Austin scene, I heard the old punk scene in Austin. You'd have flyer bands that they never did gigs, but they put flyers up.
Right.
So that would be an unnatural band.
I did that once where I had this not real band. And you know, we recorded a record and everything, but it wasn't a real band. But
you're playing together.
Well, we sort of did, and we sort of didn't. It's a long story. But I wanted to do this like America tour, and my first idea was that, you know, we were going to have shows in all the major cities in the States all on the same day, and I wanted to hire a mariachi.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I wanted to hire a mariachi band in each town, so people would show up, and it'd be this mariachi band. But then
it's a brainstorm.
But I didn't have the money to do that, so I just sent out. And then I did a bunch of shows where we would be playing at O'Hare Airport, and I'd say, and I because I lived near the airport, so I would, you know, I'd go there, and there was usually maybe a regular guy who played sax or something, and
Buskin?
Yeah. And so I, you know, like, "Are you going to be here next week?" And he's like, "Yeah." I was like, "All right." And I say, I'm telling folks, but I changed his name. He didn't quite know it.
That's pretty surreal. That's a trip. It's taking it up a level.
Well, it was very, very convenient.
You know, I'm going to work my way up to the gig. But you actually started to do a gig.
Yeah. Well, I did.
Or at least prac with some dudes in a garage.
Well, in college I had a group whose name is so embarrassing now I don't want to say. But that was kind of like that, it was kind of like that stuff that was coming out of New York at that time, like the Golden Palominos and Material. Like it was, you know, because I was starting to get into, you know, stuff like the American, because, you know, I was, by that time I was like really into Derek Bailey and Cecil Taylor and all that stuff. And, you know, the American, the new generation, like Zorn and them, they had started. So I was starting to get into that stuff too. So then it was, you know.
And how'd you find out about them?
Derek?
Were they in the library?
Derek was in the library because there were two ECM records by Derek Bailey. And so that's how I found out about him.
But maybe record collecting?
Record collecting didn't, well, I guess I did, you know, on a child's level, you know. But my mother, oh God, I don't want to get too many stories about my mother. But my parents didn't quite understand why I needed to buy records. Yeah, they didn't.
You know,
quite,
listening.
Yeah. They didn't quite understand that, because like if I bought more than one record a week, it was like But my mother would search through my garbage can at night as I slept, and if she found a receipt from a record store when I wake up in the morning, she'd be sitting there with her hands crossed. Have you ever seen The Manchurian Candidate?
Yeah, of course.
That's my mom. No, I mean, that's exactly what she looks like, too. She looks like Angela Lansbury.
No, not exactly, because you're not going to kill her.
No, I don't. I mean, she isn't that person, although she's close. But, no, she looks exactly like Angela Lansbury in that film. So if you can imagine that, she's sitting at the kitchen table with her hands crossed, tapping one finger on the table, like just... And I was like, oh, this again.
The receipt.
Yeah, and so I'd have to sit down and, you know, I'd get berated for buying a record.
Yeah. Squandering.
So I think that's maybe why I did become a record collector afterwards. Afterwards, like once I moved out, I did for 10 years, I was a pretty big record
collector. Because you're in the record stores and you're seeing records, yeah. So you probably got hip. And so Zorn and these cats.
Yeah.
And so you want to make a band.
Yeah, yeah. And so in college, I had a band that was like, kind of that kind of thing, because, you know, it was like a bass player, and I played bass, too, and I think I even had a fretless bass then.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. Now, because I loved Jocko in high school.
Of course.
And then there was that, and then, I guess the first real
Are you writing band. The tunes in the band?
That was all improv. The band version of it was all improvised stuff. It was all.
What was the other version of it?
Well, because that was like, you remember, that was like totally the cassette days, like the cassette trading days. You know, like, you know, all those like little cassette labels in the '80s, late mid '80s, and such. So like we made cassettes, and maybe about 2/3 of it were like things I made on my own, and then there was the live tracks, which was the band, you know, and that was all improvised. The live shows were always improvised, and.
The gigs are different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, it was kind of that kind of music that was coming out then. It's sort of like improvised, but there's a beat, you know.
You ever see those guys again from that band?
I know one guy now teaches at the college we went to, but everybody else... Oh, actually, the drummer ended up... And now he plays with Ken Vandermark. And I think even Nels has played with him. Tim Mulvenna is his name. Wow. So now he's actually got a very good thing going on in Chicago. I think he sort of, I think for many, many years he was trying to play in bands and stuff, and now he's like doing other kind of music and doing actually much better at that.
So what happens after that band?
Then, for a long time, I was like just making tape music. Because that's like, because I was, when I was in college, that's when I was starting to really, you know, try to be a, whatever you want to call it.
So are you on guitar again?
No, I was just cutting tape and stuff. I think for many years I didn't play an instrument at all. I was just like cutting tape. And so for a long time, that's all I was doing. So really the first band then was this Gastro del Sol band that I did with two other people who became the new America version of Red Crayola, because when the main guy in Gastro del Sol sort of got connected with Mayo in Germany and sort of got him, well, you know, Mayo of course was still doing stuff, but
since I think it was the 60s.
Yeah, yeah, of course, but there was a period of time where he was doing things, when he was living in Germany, he was just sort of doing a really slow pace.
But there's still some. I got some German, a single or something.
Yeah, exactly. There was like I think a single and maybe
an airplane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then there was the Malefactor Ade record, which is a very odd record. But it was a time where Mayo was going to be leaving Germany, and then he hooked up with David, the guy from Gastro del Sol, and so that's how he hooked them up with Mayo up with Drag City. Than the label Drag City. And so that sort of got this new Red Crayola ball rolling. So Mayo came to Chicago and we recorded Steve Albini's place. And then, so then for, at the same time, then I was playing in Red Crayola.
But you're doing Gaster before.
Yeah, it was just a little bit before.
And Gaster's doing gigs, you're writing music for it.
Yeah, yeah. That we actually did a couple tours.
But the guitar.
That I played guitar in.
Yeah, there must have been between the, band's name who will never be mentioned, but you're on bass, on Jocko bass.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then Gaster, you must have picked up the guitar again.
Well, in the way... Well,
The Stooges crew and screwing up the timeline.
No, not at all. It's. I think I didn't play regular guitar. In a way, that's what part of the challenge for me of doing that band was, is like, can I play regular guitar again, you know? You know, so I think that was part of the challenge for me to do it. Yeah, and you know, I'm part of that. You know, with that band, it was very much a studio band. It was very much, you know, recording the things, and it was very much having to do with how it's recorded and mixed, edited, and all that. So that was all part of it. But
yeah, that's in studio.
Yeah, which wasn't a studio. It was my bedroom.
But versus the cassette.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So there's a big leap there.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the first stuff you started doing, like proper record? Was it Gaster?
Yeah, that was the first time I was ever able to record in an actual studio. Was it maybe the first or second Gaster record? We actually went to a studio, and I was amazed. It was the first time I was able to use an actual studio. So that was kind of wild. But then at the same time, that's when I started recording people's records, because I was, you know, during college, I would do sound at events and stuff, so I sort of taught myself how to engineer. And so
So you must have known about gigs, Wings gigs, punk gigs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is all at the same...
Does that come with college?
That actually is high school.
High school.
And, like, my friend and I used to... There's, I think, maybe two of the Dead Kennedys records. You know how it would have the list of names of people who contributed to the college? We're on there. And Derek O'Grodney and me. And we actually did an interview with you then. For us.
So you had a zine.
Yeah, Social Smegma.
That's crazy. Of course.
The first fire hose.
What gave you the idea to do a zine?
Because, in high school, my friend then, Derek, he was into punk and I was into, jazz and that
Georgie
stuff. And so we were friends, and so we basically just exchanged. I'd go to his house and he'd turn me on to, that's how I found out about
you. The gramophone really wasn't doing the gigs where there was actually punk bands coming through.
Yeah, okay. So, saw a lot of bands.
Dead Kennedys, obviously.
I actually never saw the Dead Kennedys.
Oh, but you're on the...
But I saw Mr. Biafra do talk and stuff, but I didn't get to see them live. I think the time they played in Chicago, I could go see them, I was still too young. It was a club where I couldn't get in. Because in Chicago, it was tough to do all ages shows in Chicago at that time, if I remember.
Yeah, if I remember
correctly.
Yeah, yeah, I remember.
And so I actually couldn't see the Minutemen. But I did see the first... I still remember the first Firehose gig at the Cabaret Metro.
Yeah.
And which is interesting connection, because at that show, you guys were playing with Slovenly.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I saw Tom.
That's where Watson is.
I thought Slovenly was fantastic. Because I'm going backwards before Red Crayola and all that. And I thought Slovenly were awesome. I thought they were awesome. I still think they were awesome. And so I really got into them. You know, because I already knew the SST. Although being in Chicago, it's almost like this gang thing. You had to be more touch and go. You know, because I already, I was really into Killdozer. I loved Killdozer.
But they're Milwaukee?
Yeah, but because they were part of the touch and go family.
I know it's only 100 miles.
Yeah, yeah.
So and touch and go too, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's how I, found out about Slovenly,
So with Gaster... You're going into real studios.
Yeah.
And then you're also recording other people.
Yeah, that's why I started doing that, and mostly because of Drag City. Because, Drag City was still a small label then. It's still,
How'd you run into them?
Because of David, who I think he hadn't done anything with Drag City before then, but we were starting the Gaster stuff, and we were already starting to record, and we ran into them. And David sort of talked to them, and they said they'd do it. Because he had connections with other bands. I think he had played in, with Royal Trucks at a couple gigs. And it was kind of the family,
Yeah, yeah.
And so, because...
Old punk is a lot about people.
Yeah.
So I don't think maybe younger folks coming on understand. It was all about knowing, not so much like elitists and stuff, but it was about people bumping into each other and making connections. Mm.
Well, it's funny because I think something that's lost with the internet generation, I guess, I'm not going to get in because this is a big rant of mine.
Okay.
but it doesn't matter how, it's like how you always say, it's like you could know someone for years by phone or mail or now email, and you could have talked for the equivalent of days on email, but all it takes is 2 minutes being next to each other to make something happen. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I mean, of course I know you know what I mean.
No rhetoric.
Yeah. So that's how it happened. And then Drag City was still a very small label at the time. I don't mean that insultingly, but it was. And so I was a cheap engineer, meaning free. So I started doing Smog Records, I was started doing that, and then other labels in Chicago that were happening at the time. I did the first two U.S. Maple records.
Gun for Hire.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was like the gun for free, And it was great because they were you know, they were great. That was a good time for Chicago. The early 90s, that was a really good time in Chicago. There was really good bands. And I think people were still kind of hungry then. There was no externally decided scene.
Yeah.
was actually just something that happened because people were doing things.
Yeah, which is great.
So it was a good time there at the time. And so, you know, I got to work with good people, and I got to, you know, at least hopefully learn to be a better engineer and at that way. And then I met Steve, Mr. Albini, and he was very supportive, and, you know.
What about the acoustic guitar, John Fahey?
Well, the funny thing with the Fahey thing is I heard it when I was younger, and then I think because I had all those years of sort of rejecting the guitar.
How'd you hear it? Because of the library?
The library again, yeah. But the first time I heard that type of guitar, it's actually funny, was on a Genesis record.
Yeah, of course.
I was so funny. I was so into
totally
Genesis.
Totally serious.
I was so into Genesis, it's unbelievable. I was so crazy into Genesis when I was young. I still love the Peter Gabriel period. But there was a kind of that kind of track on one of the records. And but then a record store had opened in Chicago, this record store called Reckless Records, when I was in college. And when it first opened up, all the stock they had brought from their English stores in exchange for new records, you know. So because of that, I sold all my Coltrane records, my Miles Davis records, my Fahey records, everything, for a bunch of crap Throbbing Gristle bootlegs. Which very quickly I soon learned was a big mistake. So for many years I didn't have the records, and I kind of did. I guess I didn't think about it for a while. And then after I met Henry Kaiser, I was out visiting him, and he put it on. I was like, oh yeah, Fahey, yeah. And so I started getting into it again. And all of a sudden, I kind of glommed onto this connection between, like, really kind of drone-oriented minimalist music, which I was also really into. I was like, wait a minute, this is kind of the same thing. It's really kind of the same thing. Because when I was young, I thought of Fahey as a guitarist.
Yeah.
You know? And when I got older, I didn't look at him that way. Because I'd gone away from him for a while. Not gone away, but you know what I mean. I just didn't listen to it that for a while. When I went back, I had a completely different perspective on it. And so then I got really sort of, it was sort of like a real fire for rethinking my own stuff, you know. So that's, and then I think it was just, you know, a few years later was when Byron Coley and other people were helping him get going again. And this label sort of decided to give John my phone number, and unbeknownst to me, he already had records, because I think he had like an old prepared guitar record of mine, which is the kind of stuff he liked. He liked like making noises on the guitar, you know.
This is stuff after Gaster.
This is sort of at the same time. It's sort of happening at the same time, and so then Fahey called me up and we talked on the phone.
No, but when you made that prepared guitar.
The prepared guitar stuff's like earlier.
It's before Gaster.
Yeah. It's before Gaster. It's like in the early 90s.
But it's man on one on one.
No band. Yeah. But that during that time, I was going to Europe. I'd spent all my time in Europe because you could actually go and play and do that kind of stuff, you know. So most of the early 90s, I spent in Europe, you know, because I that's why I rarely played in the States. I've never done a tour in the States my own, you know. So I think I played once in San Francisco. I played, before I moved to New York, I played there once. And otherwise, I just played in Chicago.
So you think that label turned John onto those records? Or he stumbled onto them?
I think someone in, you know, in Oregon, you know, because, you know, he had friends.
Right.
And so he knew that record. So the label put us together on the phone, and we talked. And that's how the book happened. The book that came out later, because he told me, he's like, well, you know, we were talking about movies, and I said something about somebody, about Antonioni. He's like, oh, I punched that guy out. I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, yeah. I'm like, what do you mean you punched him? He tells me the story. He's like, I got it written down somewhere around here. And I was like, really? Wow, I'd love to read that. And I kind of didn't think of it. And about a week later, I get this big box from him, filled with manuscripts that's got food on it, and, you know. And, you know, of course, I wasn't the only person who knew about his writing, but that got that, and then this guy, really great guy named Dean Blackwood, who helped John start his new label. And then with Drag City, that's how the books started happening. You know, just that's how the ball on that started. Yeah, it's the same thing. It's just like people met people, and then you go, you know, do you know about this? Yeah. So that's it. Kind of is, there's no like, it's not. You know, I understand how from the outside it looks like some sort of, I don't know,
cabal.
Yeah, but it's not. It just sort of happens. You know.
That's right. Yeah. And yeah, it's almost like gravity and friction at the same time. Yeah. Okay. The fairy thing.
Yeah.
The Gaster plays itself out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that sort of fell apart. And
why's that?
It's a long story. And but then right around when that was happening, that's when I was almost doing nothing but producing records, and then
so you're no longer the engineer.
With the Drag City things, it started becoming producing, like, you know, at
first. So another cat.
Yeah.
Being the knob man.
Yeah. Maybe I was always the knob man.
Okay.
But
what's the difference? Was it a big change for you?
Well, at first it just became a thing. At first it was just like
for the band. Some people like a producer knob slash knob man.
Well, see, I think Steve's not a producer. No. Steve's almost a producer by default. Sometimes, if he hears this, I think he'll understand what I mean. He's the producer by default sometimes because the bands are scared to you know, because Steve has opinions which are very well informed and very interesting,
yeah.
And you know, he's an incredibly smart guy,
yeah.
And Steve's opinions are great to hear. But if the band is scared or young, they may almost by accident default he produces them because yeah. They're you know. But Steve is not a producer.
Okay, when you went into the role.
Well, at first it was almost like the same thing like Steve. Yeah. You know, it's like, I think this, and, you know, band either listens to me or not. And then more and more it seemed the bands or artists. It seemed more when I started working with singer-songwriters, those people more wanted me. It was almost like, for this record, you're my, you know. It was more like that, like with the Smog records, for yeah. instance. Those were probably the first records I really full-on produced, where it's sort of like, you know, together we're going to conceptualize and make this record happen. Yeah, yeah. So it's sort of like a team effort.
Now, when you related to the knob man.
Well, I never was much of a knob man because I didn't like gear.
Ah.
I was never much of a gearhead. And
so you would say, make it be so.
No, I learned how to do
it.
But I didn't like the whole fetishizing of the, gear.
Yeah.
And but I learned how to do it. And I was kind of more the kind of way, like, well, you get the mic, you put the mic in the right place and you get a good performance. It's probably, and you know, I did produce bands that were very production heavy, and sometimes it was fun to do, but I think in retrospect I kind of regret those things because they were a little too gear oriented, and I think that's why I don't think those records have aged well, you know, those particular records. And then, you know, at the same time there was still like the weirdo music, you know, I was still involved in that, and that's kind of how the Sonic thing happened.
We're at the end of the second hour, so we hold on for that. Hold tight for hour three.
Jesus.
Watt from Pedro Show, July 27, 2007. July 27, 2007. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show, and here's part four of Jack Flanders and Tropical Hot Dog Night.
You can put me down, all right?
I'm carrying you all the way to the boat.
Okay, up to you.
Mojo.
Yeah, Jack, we're maybe 10 minutes away.
Can you find your way?
Getting pretty fuzzy out there, but I think I know where I'm going.
Well, as soon as you arrive, we'll get underway, okay?
Aye, aye, Captain.
Did he say Claudine is fading?
That's what he said.
There is no color.
It's the fog.
No, look, my hand, there's no color.
Oh, that's because you're Canadian.
I have pigment, I am pink.
Well, you just got deeping. Man, you are heavy for someone so skinny.
That's because I'm all bones, muscle, and brains.
Okay, I'm setting you down. You and your fat brain can walk the rest of the way.
Oh, but we were enjoying the ride.
Well, how about next time you give me a lift?
We think not. Hello? We are here.
Oh, man. It's getting like pea soup out here.
Hello? Claudine?
I can feel this fog wants to play. Okay. I'll play with you.
Ojo, is that you?
That's me.
We're pushing off.
Aye, Captain Jack.
Claudine, what is wrong? I feel strange. You're so pale. So are you. Are you feeling nauseous?
No, it's something else.
Something you ate?
No, not that. There's something in the fog.
Jack said you were becoming translucent.
I think I was.
Oh, we are leaving now.
Oh, I need to rest.
You'll come back another time, yes?
I don't know about me.
We're getting clear of the fog now.
God, it's like cotton candy. It's so sticky.
That stuff sure can suck the color out of you.
Out of you, Mojo?
Well, not that much. But did you see out there in the street, everything was in black and white?
Yes, I did notice that.
Is that what happened to Claudine?
It was taking more than just her color. It was taking her.
You think she would have disappeared?
I don't know.
Where are we headed?
The next island. Kimakan.
This is a strange fog, is it not?
How's Claudine?
She's resting.
Oh, that's good. Maybe you should, too.
No, I'm too excited. I want to spend the night on Himalago. I want to watch the fog come creeping in on little leopard feet.
Leopards don't have little feet.
Are you with me?
I gotta do a little preparation before I let myself get sucked back into that stuff.
Mojo, are you frightened?
I just want to know where I stand on that fog's food chain.
We arrived at Kimakanda late that night. We decided to stay on the island for a few days while we planned our next move. Okay, listen everyone. Claudine and I feel it's best that we don't talk about Kimalagro.
Why not?
Because they may feel that we've been sort of infected.
What, we have some kind of contagious virus?
I hear the people on this island don't like the people on that island.
Mojo is right. Let's see what we can find out. But please, don't tell people where we were.
Okay, my lips are zipped. I'll have the chicken salad, please.
Anything to drink?
Iced tea, yes.
Excuse me, are you Canadian?
Yes, from Montreal. And you are American?
Yeah, from New Jersey.
You don't sound like New Jerseyer.
Not everyone sounds like, "Yo, Vinny, get me a beer."
Now that sounds right.
I haven't seen you here before.
Oh, we are island hopping. Hop, hop, hop.
Sounds like fun.
Have you been to the other island?
Which island?
Kimalagro.
No.
I hear strange things happen on that island.
I know.
What did you hear?
I can't talk now.
Perhaps later? This evening?
All right.
I meet you here?
No, there's a bar down at the docks. The Jolly Rodriguez.
Is that an Hispanic pirate bar?
It may have been.
I will see you there. Oh, what time?
7?
Okay, 7. Salut.
Yeah, Dominique and her zipped lips. Next time we'll use crazy glue.
Last night we were on Kimalago. Oh, I shouldn't say that.
You spent the night there?
We left when the fog came.
Did anything happen?
One of our crew became ill. Now she's fine.
What is it like?
It is a strange island.
People go there. They don't come back.
Why don't they?
I guess they like it there.
What do people here say about Kimalago?
Ki Diablo.
Pardon?
They call it Ki Diablo.
Devil's Island? Really?
Yes, really.
Ki Diablo. It sounds exciting, no?
I know. And it's so boring here.
You have never been there?
No.
I don't understand. You come all the way from New Jersey and you don't visit an island that is, what, 20, 30 kilometers away?
It's not a place you go just to visit.
Why not?
Like I said, they don't come back. But if they do, they pack up and leave.
They go back to Ki Diablo?
Yeah.
Why?
I think it's because they feel alive.
Alive enough to never want to return here?
Isn't that reason enough?
So why haven't you gone?
I don't want to be taken over.
What takes you over?
I don't know.
Is it a monster?
You know about that?
Yes, of course.
Did you see it?
No, but it intrigues you, yes?
A little, maybe.
You should go see for yourself.
Are you going back?
Do you want to come?
No, I don't think so.
The second day on Key Makanda, Rose arrived. We had met Rose in San Miguel. Later, when Bunny, the youngest member of our crew, went back to school, Rose asked if we needed another crew member. And we said, why not? The only person who complained was Mojo.
What are you saying? I never complained about Rose.
Oh, yes, you did. You said three women and only two men. Man, those women will have us outnumbered, outvoted, and outwitted.
That's the truth. You keep packing this boat with smart women, and we're going to find ourselves drifting in a dinghy while they go sailing off into the sunset.
Well, that sounds like mutiny.
They don't need no mutiny. Not when they can outsmart us.
You know, Mojo, there are times you just have to take the chance.
I know. So when is Rose coming?
Oh, sometime before noon.
She coming in on the Allen Hopper?
Yeah, Dominique is meeting her.
So when are we going back to Key Diablo?
Well, that'll be up to Claudine.
I'd like to get back there soon.
Yeah? You are so eager.
I've got a feeling about that place.
What are you feeling?
I don't know yet, except I got it.
Well, if we're going back there soon, I think we'll have to do it without Claudine.
I understand that.
Mojo, what do you think they mean when they refer to the monster in the fog?
Is the monster in the fog, or is the fog in the monster?
You know, I've been thinking about that, too.
Either way, it's going to be hell to pay when the monster comes out to play.
Dominique! Rose, there you are. Let me give you a hug.
Oh, you are so strong, Dominique.
Ah, see my muscles. I work out. Not that way, stick figure like mine, eh?
Oh, impressive.
Yes, I am. Listen, did Claudine tell you about Key Diablo?
No, but she did mention Key Milagro.
There is a monster.
A what?
A monster inhabits Key Diablo.
Key Milagro is Key Diablo?
Yes.
Well, is the monster a devil?
I don't think so.
Then why do they call it Key Diablo?
Because people go there, and they don't come back.
Well, what happens to them?
Maybe the monster eats them.
You are not going to.
Come on. When you see Claudine, she will explain.
There's not really a monster, is there?
I hope there is.
Oh, my God.
What I think that waiter was talking
Dandy
about...
Danny.
That's his name?
That's what they call him.
I read something Oliver Sacks had written.
The neurologist?
Yeah. He was saying that humans cannot see movement.
What?
We take snapshots and put them together into overlapping mosaic patterns, and we perceive it as movement.
Like a film?
Exactly.
A zoetrope.
What is that?
It was invented in the mid-19th century.
No, actually, zoetropes go back to China around 180 A.D.
Is that the cylinder that spins around and projects images like a horse and it appears to be galloping?
It used to be called a magic lantern.
The first motion pictures.
We can't actually see movement?
No, we can't. We constantly take still shots. So what we think we see are not only images we choose to take snapshots of, but also how we choose to arrange them. And that's determined by our upbringing, our conditioning, our faith, our beliefs, and so on.
And that is how we see and how we determine what is reality.
Man, no wonder no one agrees on anything.
You got that right. So that's all we know.
If you don't mind my saying, you don't know very much.
There is something in that fog.
Yeah, I could feel it reaching for my shadow. Like it wants to come out and play.
What do you know about the history of Key Milagro?
We know nothing, right?
The locals around here don't like talking about that island.
Do they have a library?
I believe there is, yes.
Well, can we get on the internet?
Yeah, but it'll probably be dial-up.
I'm going to see what I can find.
Thank you.
avoiding skinheads and the law. It was a freedom that we never felt before. And now we're doing this instead.
angoisse aux déplumés. Paris est toujours sa dentelle, comme un sinistre messager. Toute la ville la connaît, depuis le temps qu'elle parcourt. Dans tous les sens, par tous les temps, et la campagne environnante. Et le moindre pavé de rue, petit passerait tout martelé. Et sa démarche spatialée, sans souci du temps ni de l'heure. La folle, la folle, la folle, la folle, la folle, la folle.
All right, Jim, there's three more songs.
Oh, right.
What did we just hear?
first was which one?
What did we just hear?
Oh, well, we just heard Present for Nancy by a Dutch prog rock band called Super Sister.
What year?
That's maybe 1972. It's around then. And they made like 6 or 7 records, and very keyboard oriented a little bit, you know, like obviously like sort of, you know, I was a classically trained musician prog rock, you know, with a little bit of that sort of Zappa, like, let's look at the world in a different way sort of humor, which I actually don't like anymore, but I liked it when I was young. You know, that kind of circus kind of feeling. But I still like Super Sister quite a bit. And before that was this woman named Mama Bay from, I forget where she's originally from, but she made records in France. And she was sort of in the, I guess you could sort of, like a good starting reference point would be something like Brigitte Fontaine, but in the early 70s there was a couple French singers who sort of came from this Brigitte Fontaine, like sort of very theatrical, very sort of outspoken, expressive kind of singing, but used kind of a rock band backing instead of arrangements and, you know, music hall kind of sound. There was another really great woman named Catherine Ribeiro, who used a band that sort of sounded like metal era Pink Floyd as her backing band. And her records are terrific. And so that's Mama Bay, that song called La Folle. Is that La Folle? I guess it's in French, La Folle. And then before that was English prog rock band from, I believe, 1972 again, Egg. You know, they made 3 or 4 records, and that was from their album Polite Force. And that was called Visit to Newport Hospital. That was like an Oregon drums bass trio.
Yeah.
Great band.
I'm into Oregon bass.
I love Egg. Egg is terrific. That's a great record. I recommend it to everyone.
Oh, okay. Look, I got to piss.
All right.
So, yeah, you don't have to hear about that, but... Sonic Youth.
Right. Well, actually, it's sort of the funny part about that. It sort of starts like back at the same time. Like I said, when I saw you, for example, my friend and I had the zine, and he was into Sonic Youth, of course, you know, as you would be at that time. That was around the time I think when Bad Moon Rising came out, maybe. I remember thinking some of that was okay, but the thing is, he wanted me to hear them because he said, oh, you like that noisy music. You're going to love this band. You know, so he played me Lee Is Free. Like, I understand my younger person mentality. You know, I heard that and I was like really pissed. I was like, it's not noisy. Which it wasn't compared to the things that I listened to. But at that time, I didn't understand the context. So I was like, bah, they're not noisy. So that's kind of the funny thing is that I didn't like Sonic Youth at first. You know, I didn't like them at first because they weren't noisy enough. And so I first met Thurston in London in 90. They were there playing, and I was there for something else. And we met in a record store. So that's actually, but it's not like we had any sort of thing, but we met way before. And around the time Thurston started playing improvised music, which would be like around like 92, 93 around, and he started getting involved with that world a bit more. So I remember someone saying, oh, you got to hear this record Thurston did. You know, I was like, oh, really? You know, like improvising, really? You know, and I was, you know, I mean, I've told him this isn't like a thing. I was a bit suspicious. You know, when someone out of the blue starts playing a different kind of music, you're like, really? And I remember thinking it was absolutely fantastic. I believe, what was it? It was with Tom Segal.
Oh.
Yeah, and it was awesome. It was awesome. And so, at that time, I was playing with the Merce Cunningham Company. I was one of the musicians. And, so they were going to be doing a week-long run in New York. And so they'd always get a musician from the city they went to, you know. So the music director was a guy named Takahisa Kasugi, who's like from the John Cage generation. He was like very important from Japan. So I thought, well, why don't we get Thurston? I said, well, let's get Thurston. You know, that'd be great. So
Thurston and I spent, but we'd already sort of met up again by that time. We met up again in 94, and we sort of became friends in 94, but more because we were record crazy people, you know. So we were like record friends at first. So I think at first that's why Kim was suspicious of me. Oh, another one of Thurston's creepy record friends. Because whenever I go to New York, I go over to their house to eat, and she's like, "Oh yeah, Thurston's record friend," you know. And so at this, it kind of happened. Three things happened at the same time. So I'm doing this thing with Thurston at the Brooklyn Academy of Music every day. So I was staying in some hotel because I still lived in Chicago at that time. And I'd meet up with Thurston in the morning, and we'd hit the record stores, and then then go over to Brooklyn Academy of Music. But one day they had rehearsal. Sonic had rehearsal. He's like, "Well, just come with me and hang out." And this is when they, I think, had just gotten the place on Murray Street. So I went there, and that's when they had started doing the SYR records. And so Lee's like, "Dude," and I met Lee already in years before, in Holland. We did something together in
Man,
Holland.
"Man, your record ain't noisy."
Yeah, I still, compared to what I, it wasn't noisy, you know. So, you know, I gotta understand the context here. So, you know how it is. I just wanted a full disclosure about my childhood opinion. So, they trust me, they know. It's kind of a long time. So Lee's like, "Dude, let's play!" So, you know, Lee is. So we played. We just played for a couple hours, and
I did crack pad.
Yeah, and I did that thing with Thurston, and then Thurston and I kept doing improvised shows together, like with Ikwe Mori and stuff. And that was sort of happening. And all of a sudden, about 6 months, maybe a year later, Lee sends me this DAT tape. This is back when you still send DAT tapes to people, you know, like, you know. And he's like, "Dude, we're putting it out." So that became SYR3.
Oh, wow.
And so Kim was starting to do her trio records then. And she and Thurston got the idea of having me mix it because they had, like, the just put out Smog record at that time. So I went and I mixed Kim's record. And then the Goodbye 20th Century thing happened around the same time. And that was Willie Winant's idea. And so I already knew Willie through Henry Kaiser, so the Sonic folks were like, "Well, Jim's good too because he has a background in that music, and let's do it." So the six of us, you know, made that record. So all that stuff was sort of converging, and I still lived in Chicago then, so it was really just kind of go and do something, like, you know. And then it kind of just happened where the next record they were doing, they wanted to go. They had recorded it, but there were problems with the studio, and they wanted to try something different. So they asked me, like, "Well, Jim, will you mix it?" And I was like, "Okay, yeah, that'd be fun, you know. So I went, and nobody played bass on the record. This is kind of the key thing. There was no bass on the record because I think, was it starting maybe with Thousand Leaves? Kim went like full on guitar. You know, there's bass here and there, but full on guitar again. But they hadn't yet recorded any bass. And I remember Kim and Thurston like, "Well, you know, we can't really hear a bass on it. You know, it's like we're just thinking three guitars and drums." And I was like, "Okay." And like, and I said, "But Jim, if you have an idea for bass, put it down." And that's the hinging thing. So I was like, "Okay, I'll try something." And I think there's like maybe three or four songs in the record I play bass. So, you know, it's fine. You know, the studio, they like the parts. They're like, "Yeah, that helps those songs. The other songs didn't need bass." So mixed it was, you know, it was hard work because the studio, there were problems with the desk and stuff, so the recordings had been compromised. So it was kind of long work. But I sort of lived at the studio for like 2 months doing it. And I'd wake up and work, and, you know. So that happened. And then basically they said, "Well, you know, how are we going to do this stuff live?" And they're like, "Well, why don't you come out with us this summer?" And I thought, "Well, that'd be, you know, fun." So, you know, I'd never done a real tour, you know. And so I was like, "Well, this would be fun, you know." First time, I'd never really seen America, you know, because whenever I did go play, it was usually going over to Europe. So I was like, "Oh, that'll be fun," and with them. And, you know, I'd gotten to know Kim and Steve better by then, you know. So then it just kind of, they kind of just didn't let me, they kind of just said, "Well, okay, we're going to start the next record." Like, "Oh, okay." Well, you know you're playing, right? I was like, you know, and I enjoyed playing with him, and it was rewarding, so I just kept doing it, you know?
You did more than bass, though, with the gigs.
Well, at the gigs, if right. Basically, if there were tunes from anything off that, not on that record, I was playing guitar. On that first tour, I played guitar. I played bass on the tunes from Ghosts and Flowers, and then I played guitar for the rest. They just said make up a part, you know. I tried to stay out of the way, you know. But whenever there was a noise thing, of course, I went haywire. that turned into a nightmare later on. The last tour I did. It wasn't a nightmare. It was great. I think better for everybody else is a nightmare. Really, the last tour, I think it was great. It's one of my fondest memories, actually. Pretty much every show, it was two shows. There would be like a 2-hour, whatever long Sonic set. And then the last song, of course, you know, has the noise thing. And Thurston and I would just keep going. Everybody would leave. And
Hallraker.
Yeah. And Lee had bought this camera, so he got really into like recording. And we always play for half an hour after everybody left the stage. Just Thurston me going. So that whole tour was like a bonus show at the end. So I really enjoyed that. But then it just sort of, you know, and I moved to New York, and, you know, it was great.
But the records became different. It wasn't like, whoa, do you hear any bass on any of these songs? You got brought in.
Well, starting with Murray Street, we wrote all the songs together.
Yeah.
You know, of course, how it is, either, you know, somebody has like a song, you know, which is like, could be, like, for instance, played on an acoustic guitar or something.
The core.
Yeah. And they bring it in, and then, you know, that's the way. That's one of the things I really liked about playing with them, is that it truly was a sort of democratic band, because those songs would not sound like that if it wasn't those four people making it. It wasn't like, you know, Thurston's song with other people playing. It's like, yeah. It really, the way they're dynamic, it really changes everything. So, I really enjoyed that sort of way of working, in the sense that I wasn't in charge, which I didn't want to be, but I also wasn't like sort of just adding a part. You're like, everybody add a part, and you would adjust what you did to that.
Yeah, dynamic.
Yeah, it was much. Yeah, it wasn't sort of like, oh, that part works well with this. It's like you would adjust. And so on Murray Street, Kim and I would split the duties. It was kind of just like. We'd say, like Kim would say, oh, I want to play guitar in this, or I want to play bass on this, you know, and that's how it got decided.
Because she started playing bass again.
Yeah. And we don't play alike at all. So
yeah.
So it was kind of cool, you know. So it was, you know, it was great fun. And then, of course, we were doing all sorts of other things together at the same time. You know, Thurston was playing more and more improvised music, and started playing with Chris Corsano a lot, which was great, and so that's how that happened.
How many records?
Well, like straight, like the major label song records was three. And then there was, you know, tons of like, you know, the like more weirdo things and side things. So it was three records. I guess, yeah, three records. And
how many tours?
Oh, God, I can't even. I have no idea. It was way beyond my head. It was like, you know, I jumped into a giant pool that I didn't, I became my life, you know, because it's because they are a big band, and you know, their world is their schedules and their world are decided by an enormous amount of factors, which was not something I was used to, you know. So it was sort of like something you plug into, you know. And I mean, all honestly, like around that same time, the last record I had done on my own wasn't that well received, and I thought it was like the first time I finally made a record that was halfway decent, and people didn't really like it, and so I kind of gave up. And this is around 2001, early 2001. So I just kind of gave up. So it's not like I gave up, but it was easier to just sort of like dive in. It was easier for me, so I just kind of gave up everything and just concentrated. I, you know, produced somebody's record from time to time, but for 5-6 years out, you know, I just kind of concentrated on playing with them.
Yeah. And then?
Well, part of it was more and more, you know, since the first time I came to Japan, like in 93 or so, I'd always loved it here. But then the last few years, whenever I come here, I get really kind of, really bent out of shape, isn't that the right way to put it? like, it just really took its toll on me when I have to go back home. Like, more and more I knew, I kind of was starting to know that it's what I wanted to do. And it was also when I started thinking I better learn the language. And I think I just didn't want to play music anymore. It wasn't because of them. It's like I just didn't want to do it anymore. But the main thing is the last few times I came to Japan with the Sonics, and I came a couple times on my own. Whenever I go back to New York, I mean, it was just really killed me to go back. It was really killing me. I mean, I'd spend weeks doing nothing just because I was just bummed that I'd come back. So I kind of knew more and more that that's what I had to do. And I think maybe for a year, I didn't do anything about it because I was kind of torn up about hurting them. Obviously, I know they're fine. It's like they didn't need me, obviously. You know, they've done it for like 25 years, you know. But they're my friends.
Yeah.
And I'm not good at stuff like that. So it took me a while to get the guts to... Because I wanted them to... I needed them to know it wasn't a music thing. Or, you know, it's just like I just... My life was going to change at that time whether I was playing with them or not, you know, because I was... It's just... It was time to do it.
Yeah.
So it took a while and to get the guts to do it. And then I kind of just dived in and left the States.
Of all them songs that you played with them, what was your favorite?
In favorite, maybe on record, was maybe... Okay, I know.
No, like played at gigs.
Played at gigs?
Because that could mean old tunes and shit.
Favorite tune to play at gigs was... that's kind of a tough one, because there was a lot. I mean, it's easier
that's
probably...
That's why it's a Wide Room Pedro show.
Yeah. I think maybe it's easier to think of the songs I didn't like to play live, because there was only a couple. I didn't like them. It's just they weren't as fun to play live.
Jim from Japan.
Okay, my favorite song to play live was, for a while, it was New York Ghosts and Flowers.
On that tour,
that was my favorite to play. After that, I liked playing Pattern Recognition because that had some kick. But I probably
what old one?
Old one.
Like from a record before you were in the band.
That would be, you know, actually, I loved playing Total Trash, but I think we only did it once.
Wow.
I can't, that's...
They're
that's,
doing it now.
Like, really? Yeah, that's true. Damn you. Because when I started getting a little bit of, cojones or whatever, I sort of said, come on, Thurston, let's do it. And of course, Steve wanted to do it, you know. And he's like, I understand why Thurston wanted to do it, but I loved playing that song. I liked playing of the old songs. I really enjoyed playing. Why am I blanking now? I'm seeing my hands do it. I'm blanking on what it is. It might actually be. It is Total Trash was my favorite to play. I loved playing that one. White Cross, of course. I got to go apeshit on that one.
What's your favorite one that you made with him recording?
Recording-wise would be a Sympathy for the Strawberry? The Strawberry, yeah. Yeah, that one's great.
You know what Strawberry is.
Yeah. There's two Kim tunes that are my two favorites. What's it, the one on Murray Street... Dum bum 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 bum. Maybe that's Sympathy for a Strawberry. Dude Ranch Nurse and Sympathy for the Strawberry. Okay. Those are like were studio wise and playing wise and everything perfectly realized. I thought they were just great. Those were great. I really, really was happy with those, especially Dude Ranch Nurse. It is. It's Dude Ranch Nurse. I think that's one spectacular. I think that track's great. Yeah. I like just the whole concept of that track. You know, it's much more
SYR record. That's an album with him.
Yeah, you know, funny story about that one. About a year after it came out, Thurston and I went to Austin, Texas, with Equally Mori to play, and he had to go to the radio station. So I went with him, as we walk in, they're playing this record, and they're like, "Man, what's this?" And I was like, "Man, I know." We'd always do this because, especially our kind of record collecting crazy days, we were like the sick team of.
I mean, they ended.
Well, I stopped buying records. I mean, I think Thurston's not as much into it as he used to be.
Okay.
But I completely stopped. But
he still knows what's going on, though.
Yeah, he does. I kind of stopped paying attention too, and. Yeah, and we're like, man, I know this. It'd be always the same thing. Man, I know this. I have, but it wouldn't be. I know this. It's I have this. You know, man, I know I have this. And we're listening for 10 minutes, and the DJ's looking at us like we're crazy. And we're thinking, you know, at least I was thinking. He's like, he's looking at me like that because he's like, how can you not know it? But he was right because it was SWR3. We had no idea. We had no idea. No idea. No, well, I don't really listen to records I play on. Yeah. You know, I don't. Yeah, so I don't. You know, so it was like a, you know, but that was funny. I'm really happy about the SYR4, the Goodbye 20th Century. That was a really good thing to do. I think that was a really good concept, and it was done well. And you know, a lot of these composers actually came in and played on the tracks themselves. You know, and tracks. You know, the pieces. And so, yeah, I think it was a really good thing, and I think a lot of the Sonic's younger audience, maybe, kind of like the library, maybe they check out these names.
Sonic
and,
Library.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it's like, maybe some of these kids went and checked out, you know, John Cage or somebody like that, and the ball rolls from there, you know, you just keep, because if you like one person, and then you read about that person in context of a name you've never seen before, you just check it out.
Yeah, I got the Patty Smith Horses records, because Al Lanier was listed on the back, and he was in the Blue Oyster Cult. I didn't know who Patty Smith was.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But did you know, when did Patty Smith write lyrics for, was it the second record?
Yeah. Baby Ice Dog, and Career of Evil she did on the third record.
Mm, mm. Mm.
So, but I didn't know who P. Smith was.
I see, right.
Credits.
Ah,
cult songs always had like 4 or 5 writers.
Right.
Sam Pearlman,
yeah.
Murray Krugman.
Ah, so just
the label guy was honest.
Yeah, of course. God, I just said peace.
He told me it was his idea to turn "I'm on the Lamb, but I ain't no sheep" into the red and the black. You know, that lick on the end. Just keep doing that.
Yeah.
Okay, you get the song.
Fantastic. So,
yeah. Do you got future plans for music? I know you're not doing it now.
My future plan is to try it. I mean, you know, I wrote my whole next record after I did the last one. I wrote my whole next record. It's all written, and it's like you know, like this orchestra with drums and piano. You know, but like the thing is, there's no way for me to record it. Because unlike some of the people I get to produce, I could never get that kind of money to make a record myself. So that record will probably never happen, you know. So, I think I'm going to take time to find out what it is I want to do. I think that's the next thing, you know. And we'll see. I have ideas, but...
Do you play around the pad?
No. I rarely play alone. I almost never play. I get really discouraged if I play, you know. I always want to just... You know, I have like this cheap nylon string guitar now. You know, I sold, like when I left New York, I sold my instruments and everything. I sold all my stuff, and so I had this cheap nylon guitar, and I play it now and then, but after 2 minutes, I just want to throw it away. So I'm just waiting for that to change, you know. Let's see. But you know, I enjoyed, like when the Red Crayola came here a few months ago, that was fun, you know. It it still needs to be fun, but I think I just gotta find whatever the fire is, you know. I think I gotta refine the fire, you know. And I don't want to do stuff if I don't got if the fire ain't there. You know what I mean? You know what I mean?
Sleepwalk.
Yeah, it's. I mean, there's no reason to make a record just because you can, you know. Yeah. Even though people probably think I just do that, but I don't. I don't. I think
maybe you're not listening to a lot of stuff now.
No, I haven't had a stereo for a year.
So I can't ask you who you like now.
Well, I mean, I can listen. I have little speakers for my computer. Actually, you know, the funny thing is, I was listening at Stooges' box all last week. The sessions box.
Fun house.
I don't really know anything new. I really don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I basically anything new by my friends I listen to, but like as for like new.
So I couldn't ask you about the Japanese music scene.
I don't really know about it.
Tokyo scene.
I don't really know about it. You know, I mean, I have old friends here who I still listen to when they make a record. You know, I still listen to it. But as for new things, I really don't know. I'm trying to think if I.
I can't ask you what their scene is like.
I don't even know. I never go to show. I almost never go to shows here. I don't know. I mean, it's.
You couldn't tell me about Boris.
I know about them, but I don't know it. I really don't know it. Okay. I know one record of theirs because they made a record with Mertzbau, and you know he might still listen to like regularly, like clockwork. So he made a record with them, so therefore I heard that one, which it was great. But I just don't know.
Okay.
You know, yeah, I just don't know. It's funny.
I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
And
no idea.
Yeah, next time I'm here, we'll do another one.
I'll talk less next time.
No. No, we probably covered some history you don't have to redo.
Yeah, we can talk about things.
Yeah.
I suppose.
You might have rekindled fire.
I don't know. I think I'm going to rekindle the fire of people wanting to kill me. I better stay home for a while now.
Well, thanks you for becoming aboard.
No, all the other Kochiko, so that I got the.
Oh, great! And this was July 27, 2007, Watt Pedro show. Keep your powder dry.